Good evening. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. And along with K2 Kilo Echo Yankee, Mel, the two of us run a thing called the Technical Med. Technical Med is a gathering of the clan in which people come together and attempt to help each other, and 90-some-odd% of the time we're successful. The hobby of ham radio is reasonably complicated. There's an awful lot to learn about antennas and transmission lines and transmitters and receivers and propagation and the 26 different kinds of ham radio. FM repeater, 2-meter ham radio, it's just one of the 26 kinds, the one you're listening to right now. And if for some reason you become displeased with that one, try one of the other 25. Meteor scatter, moon bounce, HF, UHF, SHF, and so on. Computers and wireless, that's the modern trend, the coupling of computer technology and wireless technology. D-Star, weak signal, Joe Taylor, and it just goes on and on and on, the number of modes, automatic positioning techniques, and so on. A person signs into the TechNet because he has a question or a comment for the net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes after that, which means you do have a question or a comment. So please give me your call letters and name at this time. K2LIW.
And so we owe. Good evening, Dick. No questions.
Rich with a no. Anyone else?
WA2RAS. Yes.
6DPZ with a no.
DPZ with a no. Mr. RAS, please tell us your name, sir.
Jeff, Juliet Echo, Foxtrot, Foxtrot.
Okay, Jeff with a yes. So far we've got Rich with a no, DPZ with a no, and Jeff with a yes. Anyone else?
Evening all, K2KEY.
And Mel with a yes. He's usually got a comment or two. Anyone else? One more call. Anyone to sign into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
KC2QFJ, Stephen, yes.
Very fine, Stephen. And that's QFJ, Quebec, Foxtrot, Juliet, is that true?
That's Roger.
Okay, we got you, Stephen. And one more call. Anyone else to sign into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name at this time. Okay. Looks like it's a fairly late night tonight, Jeff, so you can probably ask a whole lot of questions and we can get very deep into the questions. One of the things I used to ask people in the past is, hey, am I too verbose? Should I be more brief? And the answer usually comes back, yeah, please be more brief, but when you get to my particular question, give me the whole answer. So I think I know what's going on. So you can ask a bunch of questions if you like, Jeff. Looks like we got a late night tonight. Whiskey Alpha 2, Romeo Alpha Sierra. K2RW. You got it, Jeff.
Okay, Dick. Thanks very much. I wanted to... this is a follow-up on last week. As you may recall, that I was the guy who had... I don't know what you call it, but it wasn't TVI. It was sprinkler interference. When I went on 80 meters, which I do often, when the PEP went over, let's say, 150 watts, it would the sprinkler system would turn on voice peaks. In other words, as the power went up, the sprinklers went on. And while that might seem like a good idea for watering the grass, it was a terrible problem because every time the sprinkler turned on, the pipes would bang together. And so, you know, this was happening as I'm talking. Wait, let me let it drop. Anyway, that was the recap. Here's the update. Looking at the attempting to solve the problem as you know, in the in the easiest way, it does appear that the problem was that RF was going through the AC line, when I just unplugged the controller for the spring, that stopped the problem. It hasn't really solved everything, although because what happens is even though there's a battery backup, the system, after it's off for a while, the system kind of freezes, you have to like clear the system by disconnecting the battery and reprogramming. But at least, you know, we don't have the severe problem that we had before. Anyway, that's my update, Dick, and thanks very much for your help and everybody's help on the net. I think I was losing my mind. K2RIWA2RIS.
Let me ask you a quick question, Jeff. The controller is fed by a 110-volt line, which probably goes to a wall port that issues something like 12 volts that goes to the actual control unit that charges the battery and runs it, the standby battery. The actual commands that are issued by the control unit, that probably has another set of wiring that goes to each remotely controlled water valve. Is that approximately true? Are the other wires coming back out of the control unit going to those control valves? And how far away are those control valves? Back to you, Jeff.
Let's see. For the first part of the question, the answer is yes. There's a wall wart, which is taking the 110 and reducing it to something. I don't know exactly what, but you know, it's a plug-in transformer. I'm not sure about the second part of the question. The valves, the distance between the control unit and the valves is approximately 10 feet, and the feed point of the antenna, if that's what you're getting at, is in reasonably close proximity. Maybe a distance of not more than 20 feet from the control unit, Dick.
Okay, so far you see evidence by unplugging the wall wart and running on the standby battery that the problem becomes improved. That does suggest that the 110-volt wiring of the house is one of the antennas picking up some of your radio energy and coupling it into the susceptible circuitry of the control unit. You've also got something like 10 feet of wiring that goes from the control unit to the external water valve, let me call them, electronically remotely controlled water valves. And the wiring to those water valves can also be an antenna coupling signals back to the control unit. And which ones are dominant and which ones are secondary is an interesting thing to know. Looks like you're making progress. If your antenna itself has a good balancing device on it, for instance, it was a dipole and it has a good balance at the center, that almost assures that no RF current flows down the outside of the coax cable, which I have the impression comes reasonably close to either the house wiring, the control unit wiring, or its remote wiring to its switches. In other words, your transmission line to the antenna could be a radiating device that aggravates the problem. So by installing a balun on the antenna, if there isn't one there already, and the balun itself could be either one of these commercially made devices that's usually in a white circular tube and it's a couple of feet long and the connectors are at the top for the antenna connection and the bottom is the coax input connection. That's one way of doing it. A poor man's way of doing it is to make sure that there is a number of turns of coax cable, 3 or 4 or 5 turns of coax cable, a couple of feet in diameter, near the antenna, taped together. Even if there isn't enough coax there, it's perfectly legal to add an adapter so that the end of the transmission line goes to a number of turns of the coax cable, which are taped together, and then that in turn proceeds onto the antenna. That is a kind of an RF choke. It's a poor man's equivalent of a balloning device.
Repeater, timeout.
So either by the use of a commercially made balloning device, or the homebrew balloning device of a coil of cable that I'm suggesting, is a way of creating improvement. May not be the cure-all, but that'll create improvement. Now that you know that the wiring is implicated, the right kind of a split ferrite device, RFI, radio frequency interference ferrite device that you can buy from Radio Shack, and you put that on the wiring from the Walmart to the, put it over the wiring from the Walmart to the control unit, as close to the control unit as you can get, that will help. Similarly, placing those devices on the wiring going to the remotely operated water valves will help. See, the ferrite device acts like an RF choke, so that the house wiring and Walmart wiring and remote water valve wiring doesn't have the opportunity to act like an antenna and couple radio signals back into the control unit. Now, these are the techniques for solving the problem externally. Internally, if you're willing to open up the control unit, simply putting in a 1,000 picofarad, 0.001 microfarad, the same thing, disc ceramic capacitor in the right place, acting as an RF bypass to the grounding of the unit, the internal grounding, would also make a lot of improvement. Now, some people are very reluctant to make any modifications to the control unit because it might interfere with warranties and things like that. A serious ham radio operator doesn't worry about the warranty. He opens up the package, he adds the bypass capacitors right on the circuit board, and solves the problem right there. So there's various philosophies on how to do that. So these are the next steps, if you haven't already taken them, which could make improvement in the situation. Back to you, Jeff, if you need any more fill on some of the stuff that I just said. W2RAS, K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Yeah, this is K2KEY with a comment.
K2B with a comment also.
Okay, Mr. B.
Z with a comment.
B and Z, but first Mel. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Now that he sort of narrowed down to the AC line, I would say possibility is wrapping that wire possibly that goes from the wall wart to the unit with a ferrite rod may take care of a lot of the problems. But it's funny that I had too, a number of strange problems with 75 of all bands. I have it on a higher frequency, such as 20 meters or whatever. But it was on 75 that I had a number of also strange problems happening. And this was years ago, but when I changed over to open wire feeders, I have open wire feeders on the 75 meter antenna and the 160 meter antenna. And for some reason, that was the cure-all. Taking the open wire feeders, going into the balance input of the tuner, and seems to just magically eliminate all the problems without going any further into any of the devices, Dick, over.
And was your previous coax cable, Mel, using a balun at the antenna end, or was it a somewhat unbalanced system? Go ahead.
Both. Tried both originally. Of course, I just had the coax going up there, split off into both the wires and everything, and that was it. And then, of course, everybody says, oh, you got to put a balun. All right, that's the cure-all. I'll try anything. I put a balun. Then I put those common boat choke onto the coax that you snap on, you know, that they have they sell radio work cells, and nothing. It didn't help the problem. And in fact, you know something? I may be crazy to say it, but I think some part of it has made it worse for some reason. put the open wire feeders on and was like magic stick. I was flabbergasted that how come the open wire feeders are doing so much better than Valen, Thalen, or chokes or whatever. But for some reason, that seems to be the rule of thumb on 75 meters at least, or 80 meters, take over.
K6DPZ, your comments.
Okay, GPZ, we're going to give you right after Mr. B. It's either WA2B or WJ2B. I'm going to guess it's WA2B because Barry and Harold are doubled with each other. Barry, if it's you, go right ahead.
Are you close, Dick? You're right. It's WJ2B, Whiskey Juliet 2 Bravo. Handle here is Joe, Juliet, Oscar Echo. I just wanted to tell you that Dick was right on the money with the solution because I have the same problem with my alarm system with my voice coming through the speaker up in the attic, right? There's wires run all the way from the controller in the basement all the way up to the attic. I have a two-story house, and those speaker wires were acting as antennas. So I did exactly what Dick said, is I put 1,000 puff caps right at the terminals of the speaker driver board inside the controller, which effectively shorted out the RF that was coming down those wires and turning on the transistors in the speaker amplifier. And that got rid of the problems. And then also, the source of the problem is the feed point of your antenna, the high current point, where you got irradiating a lot of RF is just too close to your house. If you're on a small piece of property, it's just too close to the alarm wiring or the sprinkler controller head wiring that you have going from the controller to the valves. You probably have 20 or 30 feet of wire there that's acting as beautiful antennas. And that's what's causing the RF to be fed into the controller box and causing all kinds of circuitry to get activated to turn on the voltage going to the sprinkler controller valve. So definitely ferrite chucks will help, but probably will not eliminate it. The best thing is the 1,000 puff caps. I had tried ferrite chucks. I left them on anyway. It didn't eliminate it. It made it a little bit lower, but it didn't eliminate it. Once I put the 1,000 puff, that eliminated it. Once I moved my antenna feed point further away from the house, it's about 30 feet away from the house now, that also helped eliminate it. So it's a combination of that those wires acting as antennas and your antenna feed point being too close to your sprinkler wiring there. But back over to you, Dick WJ2B. Go ahead.
Very fine, Joe. Lots of good information. Thank you for that report. Okay, Harold's next. K6DPZ. What would you like to add to this, Harold? K2RIW.
K2RIW, TechNet, K6DPZ. Well, what I wanted to add was, if his antenna is not properly matched, no matter if you use a Balum or not at the top, the feed line's still going to radiate. So if he's using a tuner to drive a dipole, and he doesn't have a proper termination at the end of the dipole, the whole feed line's still going to radiate. That's my only comment. Go ahead, Dick.
Here we're in a controversial area, Hal. Without a doubt, when your antenna is not matched to the feed line, like if it's a 600 ohm open wire line and your antenna is not 600 ohm, or it's a 72 ohm dipole and you're not feeding it with 72 ohm coax, without a doubt there is reflective power on the feed line. If the feeding mechanism is sufficiently balanced by way of a perfect balance at the top, or if the antenna is perfectly balanced by way of open wire line and the antenna itself is perfectly balanced, then in theory, the reflected energy is propagating back down the transmission line identical to the way the original power transported itself up the transmission line. If the transmission line was sufficiently shielded for the first signal, it'll be equally shielded for the second signal. So in theory, there should be no increase in radiation because of reflected power. Now, where you're right is the fact that no antenna is perfectly balanced, no balun is perfectly balanced, therefore there is some amount of common mode energy on the cable. It's not all differential energy, and as such, the cable will radiate some more in the presence of standing wave ratio. Standing wave ratio itself is not the cause, it's imbalances. So there's pluses and minuses on this. There's been lots of articles written on that one. And a better matched antenna is going to alleviate the problem, like Hal said. Proper balancing and trying to space the antenna away from the susceptible circuitry, trying to rewrite the transmission, reroute the transmission line so it doesn't go near the household wiring or doesn't go near the controller wiring. All of these things will help. That's the inverse square law. Keep the antenna and its feed hardware as far away from the susceptible circuitry as possible. So, as I see it, Jeff, you're making progress, and a little bit further to go, and left-handedly, you've heard a number of suggestions from all of the above. Let's turn it back to you, Jeff, and see if you need some more fills on all this. W-A-2-R-A-S, the sprinkler man of Island Park, K-2-R-I-W. You got it, Jeff.
Okay, thanks, Dick, very much. W-A-2-R-A-S. Okay, couple of comments. First of all, let me give credit where credit is due. The first one to come up with the brute force suggestion of pulling the plug on the system was Hal, K6DPZ. Everybody's comments and suggestions are very helpful. A couple of things. First of all, there's no balun on the antenna. It's a dipole. It's fed with coax, and there's a tuner. Obviously the SWR is extremely low with the tuner. This is a small piece of property moving the antenna, and specifically moving the feed point is really not an option. I'm just happy I could get an 80 meter dipole on the property because there's no room. It's going in all different directions. Let me mention that I had an earlier problem that I had completely forgotten about with this sprinkler system in that when transmitting, and I don't think it was limited to any one band, I guess it would be, under power, the sprinkler system would turn on. In other words, this wasn't what's happening now. It wasn't going on and off, on voice peaks. The system would just fire. So in other words, if I have it set, that, and I do have it set for about 2 hours of sprinkling, you go on the air and you get 2 hours, the system turns on. Whenever you went on the air, the system went through the whole 2 hours of cycling. This problem was solved with an AC line filter. The other thing I wanted to say, wait, let me let it drop. The other thing I wanted to say is, just so you have the whole picture here, the ground for the station is connected to a spigot coming out of the sprinkler system. I don't know if that's making things worse or not, but that's my. I figured that would be a good ground, because it's connected to a sprinkler system. I just wanted you to have that fact. K2RW, W2RAS.
M2EO, Dick. Rich recognized. If you remove that ground from the sprinkler system, which possibly is an aggravating factor, and you see a change in the performance, that's worth doing. Now, the grounding that we put on our ham radio stations, there's really three reasons we put on a ground. Number one and foremost is human protection. The middle round plug on your on each one of your appliances goes into a so-called neutral connector on the wall. That in turn is grounded somewhere back near your fuse panel. And that's your primary grounding for human protection to be sure the chassis of the equipment doesn't become hot if internal fault in the wiring takes place. The second reason for grounding is lightning protection. If lightning strikes the antenna, you'd like it to have a nice, small, low impedance path to ground as opposed to going throughout all the wiring and all the appliances in your house. And the third reason for grounding is a controversial one. That is, there are people who believe that if you do a better job of grounding your equipment, there'll be less television interference. That one's controversial because it is true in some cases, not true in others. But now, when it comes to the use of the impedance matching antenna tuner in the shack, giving you a 1-to-1 visor to the transmitter, isn't necessarily a 1-to-1 at the antenna. But let's assume now that the antenna is a perfectly symmetrical, half-wave, 80-meter dipole at some reasonable distance above the ground. And in theory, a perfect half-wave dipole has something like a 70-ohm impedance at its center feeding point. And if it's just the right length, it's a 70-ohm resistor with no extra capacitor or inductor involved. Let me drop. Now, one of the things that's a well-kept secret, it's not made super clear in any of the antenna books, is that the 70-ohm impedance is the impedance between the two terminals, the broken center insulator, the center insulator that breaks up your continuous piece of wire that normally is about 130 feet long. Yes, that's 70 ohms, but it's 70 ohms balanced. In other words, the way Mother Nature works, it acts as if there is a 35-ohm resistor to ground on the right-hand side and a 35-ohm resistor to ground on the left-hand side, and the two are in series, and you see 70 ohms. But each half of that antenna is working with reference to Mother Nature's free space and ground, and it has roughly a 35-ohm impedance. That's a reasonably strong fact. Now, when you take a piece of coax cable and feed that, if I had a perfect miniature transmitter and I could mount it right at the center of the dipole, and if the dipole was being fed by 1 ampere of current out of the transmitter, it'd be a total of 70 volts of drop. The right-hand side would be 35 volts with reference to ground. The left-hand side would be 35 volts with reference to ground. That's why a completely floating transmitter at that point, that's the way it would act. Your coax cable is trying to remotely couple that signal from your shack up to the antenna and act like that transmitter is located at the end of the cable. Well, if you're pumping 1 ampere into the antenna and you got 35 volts with reference to ground on the right-hand side of the dipole, and if the right-hand side of the dipole is where you connect the shield of the coax cable and center conductor goes to the left side, because of the way Mother Nature forces that balancing action on dipole, it's obvious that close to 35 volts will appear on the outside of the shield of the coax cable, because that shield is connected to the right-hand side of the dipole, and that's just the way things act and the way Mother Nature rebalances itself. So even though your antenna tuner in the shack is doing a perfect job, and the antenna itself sees a 1-to-1 visor, without a balancing device at the antenna, the outside shield of the coax cable, because of its connection to the antenna, becomes hot.
Repeater, time out.
If correspondingly I put a shielded 70-ohm dummy load at the end of the transmission line, that would not happen. But because it is a balanced antenna that forces half the voltage to be on the right side and half the voltage on the left side, it takes your unbalanced signal coming down the center of the coax cable and forces half of that voltage to be fed back down the outside of the shield. So now you see the mechanism by which, without a balun, whether it be a poor man's balun, a couple of coils of the transmission line right at the antenna, or a real balancing device, without that balancing device, by definition, a coax cable there becomes hot. The outside becomes a radiator. Whereas if you were using, just a big an example, 70-ohm twin lead, which is a balanced transmission line to begin with, that would not happen. It's just the way balanced line works versus coax cable. That reflected signal, if the antenna wasn't a perfect impedance match, would be the same amount from the right-hand side of the dipole versus the left-hand side. If, for instance, you were using 300-ohm twin-lead transmission line on a 70-ohm antenna, there would be reflected energy, but it would only be differential energy. It's only when coax is used you get this particular characteristic. The first time you hear this, of course, it doesn't seem to make common sense. So once the transmission line itself becomes hot and it goes near any of the wiring of the house, It'll light up some of the wiring of the house. It itself radiates, and it's closer to your control box. That aggravates the problem. Putting a ground at the transmitter back to the wire, the piping of the sprinkler system could be aggravating the condition. Moving that ground or eliminating that ground temporarily as an experiment would also give you some further information. So I think you're getting a little bit more of the picture of what's going on here. Every situation of electromagnetic incompatibility, electromagnetic interference, cross-modulation, whatever, all of these situations are essentially 100% solvable. The technology is there by way of filtering, bypassing, shielding, and whatever. Every one of these is solvable. I didn't say it's easy. I didn't say it's always cheap.
Repeater, time out.
But know ahead of time that every one of them is solvable. There's many a person who has applied 2, 3, and 4 techniques to try to solve a situation like this, didn't find an immediate solution, and sometimes gave up saying it's impossible. Every one of these, every television interference, radio interference, telephone interference, phonograph interference, iPod interference, every one of them is solvable if you're willing to apply the technology. Let's see if Rich has run into anything like this, what he did. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, K2RIW, TechNet, N2EO. Yeah, Tech, I was doing some thinking because, you know, years ago I had an 80-meter dipole fed with coax, pretty much what Jeff is doing. It was not resonated. I was using a tuner, and with an amplifier I had all kinds of RFI problems. And then about 5 years ago, put up an inverted V in basically the same area of the property. Didn't give it much thought until now, but I ran open wire line, and I run 1,500 watts. I have no trouble. I mean, it's clean. The only thing I know of that I get into a little bit is my next-door neighbor's computer speakers. The telephones, televisions, there's just not a problem. So I'm a big proponent of open wire lines for the reasons you mentioned. Let me go to recycle. There's a surprisingly number of people, you show them a piece of open wire line, they don't see braid. They say, oh boy, that's going to radiate like crazy. And what you said, Nick, is really true. Each side, one side is pushing while the other side is pulling. It's a way of saying they're 180 degrees out of phase. They cancel. And there is no, the radiation off open wire lines is very minimal. Now what I do is I have a 10-foot pipe on the peak of off the peak of the roof, put up courtesy of Barry at 2MB. So that puts the apex about 35 feet in the air. The antenna is not resonant. I don't have full enough space. It's about 110 feet of inverted V fed in the center. It should be 132 feet. The open wire line comes down into the basement, and then I don't go right to the tuner. I have a device, it's a ballon. They call it a remote ballon. This is made for the purpose. MFJ makes one, but I wouldn't recommend it. The better ones are made by DX Engineering, RAS, I forget your name. you can Google DX Engineering, Jeff, I'm sorry. You can Google DX Engineering, they got them at all different power levels. What you do is you run the 450 ohm open wire line down into your shack as close as you can get it. And then no more than 10 or 15 feet of coax from the remote ballon over to the tuner. Now, another advantage, I found that the coax, and I've said this before, Dick, coax, even at low frequencies, when it's run non-resonant, the losses go up tremendously. I mean, until I went to open wire line 5, 6 years ago, I didn't know what 80 meters could sound like for this QTH. I've worked TX into Africa and Europe in the winter, running the amplifier, but I'm hearing these guys really good, and I'm on a city lot. Yeah, it's K2RIW Technet Limelight in 2EF.
O2M with a query.
Something like O2M will get you in a second. It's hard to believe that... stand by a minute. Yeah. Gotcha. Steve is in New York City. The he's going to be the next guy. And Steve, hang in there. We're going to get to you. The hard thing to believe is that open wire line, whether it be 600 ohm, 450 ohm, 300 or whatever, looks thoroughly unshielded, just like Rich was saying. But when it's used properly so that half the voltage is on the left-hand side, half the voltage is on the right-hand side, and those two voltages are always 180 degrees out of phase, equal to each other, that is a shielded structure, as long as the spacing between the two wires is a small fraction of a wavelength. When you're on 80 meters, the wavelength is something like 265 feet, and you've got a couple of inches of spacing between those two wires, so that makes it an extremely well-shielded structure as far as the RF is concerned. Your eye doesn't see it that way. It looks like it's a very open structure. That's an extremely well-shielded structure. By the same token, the 100,000-volt wiring that you've got for power distribution, for transmission lines, for LIPA and LOCO and Con Ed power, if you carefully look at the way those three leads are laid out in a triangular cross-section arrangement, because of the way the three currents are in theory thoroughly balanced and actually 120 degrees apart, that also is an extremely well shielded structure, because 60 hertz where you're running at in that case is an extremely big wavelength. You know, it's like a mile. The wavelength is like a mile. We can calculate that one, but it's something big, and you got some small number of feet by comparison of separation between those wires. So as long as those wires, those three wires, are being used in an equal manner, exactly 120 degrees of phase shift between them, and equal in current, that's an extremely well-shielded structure. You could stand under those power lines, and you think you're going to be subjected to 100,000 volts. You're not. You think you're going to be subjected to the magnetic field of 1,000 amperes flowing through those. You are not. You stand there with instrumentation measuring E field and H field, and you'll be amazed how small it is, and what little bit you get is because you're in the so-called near repeater.
Time out.
What little bit you get is because you're in the so-called near field. The fact that you're percentage-wise closer to one of those three wires than the other two, at a reasonable distance from them, it becomes a shielded structure. So many open wire radiating-like structures look like they should be transmitting like crazy, and they're not. The exception of what I'm saying is broadband of a power line. In the case of broadband of a power line, you're not feeding balanced wires. You're feeding essentially one wire at a time, and you're feeding at much higher frequencies, VHF range frequencies. So all this beautiful shielding characteristic and perfect balancing function is not there, and it radiates like crazy. And so the interference that amateurs have experienced during the small trial runs of broadband of a power line gives you some idea of what's going on, why amateurs have been unhappy with it, why ARRL filed a lawsuit against the FCC because they were ignoring their own internal information showing how much interference was really coming from that. Alrighty, I think you got most of the picture. I'm going to go to the next person, Jeff, but there's a man who just signed in right now. I forgot his call letters already. Something O2M. Start off with your name, sir, and your call letters, and tell us your comment. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Hi, Dick. Good evening. W-O-2-N. Bernie is the call. I just had a question for Jeff. I was wondering who the manufacturer of that box is, the sprinkler box. How old it is? Is it a metal box or a plastic box? And is it a digital or a mechanical? I just wanted some information on that, and mostly curious to who the manufacturer was. And that's my question. W-O-2-N.
Go right ahead, Jeff. So, we would like to know how well shielded is the box. Is it plastic? What brand name? W-H-U-R-A-S, K-2-R-I-W.
I think I forgot the third question. Let me start with what I remember. First of all, the box is not metal. The box is plastic. So forget about shielding. It is a digital box, and it's almost brand new. I had a problem. I don't remember what the problem was now, but there was a problem with the. I do know the manufacturer. It's called Hunter. I don't know why I know that, but that's the brand name. I had a problem with my previous. The sprinkler system has been there for years, more than a decade probably. So I had a problem with the previous sprinkler system, not the system, with the control box, and I forgot what the problem was, but I don't think it was related to ham radio. So this was a new box that I had installed a few months ago. I think that answers all the questions, and I certainly appreciate all the wonderful explanations, advice, and help. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Jeff. You answered all the questions. Bernie, W-O-2-M, Whiskey Oscar 2 November. It sounded like Mike at first. I wonder if you're familiar with that brand name, but the fact that it's plastic, probably not built to be near any RF circuitry, these are all aggravating factors. Any further comments on this, Bernie? W-O-2-N, K-2-R-A-W.
Hi, thank you, Jeff, there. I wonder if you had trouble with the previous box, if you had trouble with the old box, if you had the same situation. But, yeah, that brand, that Hunter is top-of-the-line stuff. That's good quality stuff. The I don't know. I have an older metal box here. It's mechanical, so I don't have as much flexibility as far as programming it, but it's an older shielded box, I guess. It's metal. So it works. I don't have a problem. Knock on metal. W-O-2-N. Thank you.
Good question, Bernie. Now, let me teach you guys something about shielding. And this is a subject that came up in my consulting business on a number of occasions. There are times where on the handheld products I've worked on, somebody is forced to put an antenna right next door to some susceptible piece of electronics. It might be an optical scanner, might be a microprocessor, might be an audio system, whatever. If you put a six-sided metallic box with all the seams of the six sides properly soldered together, around a susceptible piece of electronics, that metal box around it, in theory, is capable of giving you 120 decibels of shielding. So in other words, the signal that gets fed from the outside world through the metal walls of that box to the susceptible electronics on the inside, when it's a metal box, you could get minus 120 dB of coupling. That's the good news. Bring one single piece of wire through one of the walls of that box so that you can couple power from the outside world to the inside of the box, or so you can couple the signal back out or give it a command with a one single piece of wire going through the wall of that box could easily give you an antenna characteristic where the wire on the outside picks up the signal crawls along the wire, goes through the wall into the box like an antenna, and you can easily pick up plus 6 dB of signal. So in other words, the box itself is giving you minus 120 dB of coupling. You add one piece of wire that is not properly bypassed to the walls of the box, and you get plus 6 dB of coupling, 126 dB of shielding degradation because you added one piece of wire. That's the real world. Now, in order for you to properly bypass, shield, and whatever, that external piece of wire that's bringing in power or bringing signal back out or giving you commanding capability, to properly bypass that wire, shield it, and so on. That in itself is a science and an art form, and lots of books have been written on that subject, and people have spent a career finding the best way in compact environments to inexpensively give you the shielding that you require. So, the two naive situations...
Repeater, time out.
The two naive situations I've run into very often is that somebody has gone through a heroic effort making a six-sided box with all the edges properly soldered together, and they wonder why they're not getting shielding when they have external wiring going through those walls. Or, conversely, somebody says, I want to put a shield, and they build a little bitty metallic Quonset hut over the top of the susceptible electronics. Don't worry about the two ends, and don't worry about the bottom, and they pray that they're going to get some shielding. Well, they might get 10 dB worth of shielding, but if they need 25 dB of shielding, that's not going to cut it. And the way electromagnetic interference works is that the chain is no stronger than the weakest link, so to speak. If you've got a mechanism by which the signal can be coupled through your metal box by way of its wiring, or because you haven't shielded all sides of the box, signal is going to come roaring through, and everything you do on the other sides and the other wiring is going to make an extremely minor improvement until you get to the strongest source of the signal. Call it the weakest link of the chain, if you know what I mean. So the fact that the box is not metallic is not the be-all, end-all. The fact that the box is plastic is not necessarily bad. If the manufacturer did a real good layout of that printed circuit board, and if the input and output wiring is properly bypassed with 1,000 picofarad ceramic bypass capacitors, which would cost them about 10 cents a piece, the problem will, 95% of the time, go away. But quite often the manufacturer says, each one of those 10-cent disc ceramic capacitors is cutting into my profit, and unless the customer demands it, I'm not going to put them there. In the case of a television set that's giving you interference, the FCC has set up rules by which once you complain to the manufacturer if you bought the television set, they must supply you free of charge a high-pass filter to eliminate the majority of the ham radio interference that comes into the antenna of the television set. I'd like to believe on other susceptible pieces of electronics, like a sprinkler system control unit, that there would be a similar deal. I don't think there is. And so these are some of the goods and bad news about it all. Okay, Bernie, please come back. And here we go. I'm terrible on names. Harold? No, that's not Harold. Jeff. Jeff, please come back in the future weeks and let us know this continuing saga. I'd like to hear...
Repeater, time out.
I'd like to hear more about your problem because your problem is not unique. There's a zillion people out there, Jeff, who have got some minor version of your problem. Yours may be a little bit more severe than some of the others, but we all have, from time to time, had susceptible pieces of electronics in our house where the ham radio equipment or any other piece of wireless electronics in the house occasionally gave grief. So the problem you're solving is an extremely universal problem, and as you go step-by-step through the process of making it better, we'd like to hear about it, so please come back. Okay, Steve was the next person. Sorry to keep you waiting so long, Steve. KC2RFQ, RFJ. Is it RFJ? Yeah, QFJ, here we go. KC2QFJ. Steve, go right ahead, and what's new with you? K2RIW, my name is Dick.
KC2QIQ with a comment, though?
That was a triple. QIQ first, go ahead.
Just one thing I wanted to mention, Dick, on the last topic is a lot of new equipment today now is coming with the CE marking. And in the HF bands, what that means is as far as susceptibility or immunity to RF interference in the HF bands, that they, in order to have a CE mark, they can sustain as much as 10 volts per meter without any disruption to its performance. Just an interesting thing to look for when you're buying equipment and you're concerned about susceptibility to HF noise. KC2QIQ. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Glenn. Who is the other person who signed in?
Dick, I said, put me at the end of the list. Got a related question on open wire line. It's who we have.
Very fine, Richard. Was there a third person?
Not really, but there will be now. N2MB, just saying hello. Good evening, everyone.
N2, moonbound. Nice hearing from you, Barry. And looking forward to hearing from you right after we talk to Steve. KC2QFJ, what's going on in New York City, Steve? K2RIW.
Thank you very much, Dick, and good evening to everyone on the net. First of all, I'm using HT with 1 watt. Am I making it okay?
You're almost dead full quieting. How about it?
Very good to hear that. I've been setting up an EchoLink setup using a mobile rig set up in a base configuration. Computer link, no problem. Had that all hooked up. And an external antenna, a dual band, 2 meter and 440 vertical antenna. And I had several questions that have come up regarding the EchoLink setup. So first of all, when I use the EchoLink test server, which records everything you put out and plays it back, I felt like my noise level was very high. It didn't sound like I was dead full quiet. So it sounds like the quality of my transmission is fine with this same radio. I'm wondering if the fact that I was too close to the link radio causing what sounded like I was far away from the repeater.
Okay, there's a little bit of hiss in the background on your radio, but you're a good distance from probably Manhattan. Let's see, we've only got a post office box for your address. So I'm guessing you're in Manhattan, and to talk out to the Queens Nassau line where this repeater is, and there's probably some buildings in the way, to do that with a handy talkie is a good trick. Hopefully you're not on the ground floor of your particular building. So there's a little bit of noise in the background on that handy talkie. And if you had a way of having the signal fed back to you, you would discover that as you move the handy talkie around the room, left, right, forward, back, up, down, tilt it horizontal as well as vertical, if you could hear the signal coming back, you'd find out there are places in your apartment where the signal gets through stronger than others. And you can't do this on reception, because the reception frequency is a little bit different than the transmitting frequency, and so the best point for reception in your apartment on reception is not necessarily the best point for transmission. So, for instance, if you had a way of listening to the signal that comes back from the other repeater, the 147.375, which is linked to this repeater, unfortunately that one's out in the center of Suffolk, so you might not be able to hear that one so well, or if somebody can play it back to you over a telephone while you transmit with your handy-talkie and move around, you'll find better places. That's item number one. See, even before you put up a better antenna, and the better antenna is the way to go, a good mag mount on the windowsill or on a radiator will be a hell of a lot better than the rubber duck you're using on top of the handy-talkie. Second of all, the audio out of your handy-talkie is nice and clean, but it could be twice as loud. It's a little bit on the low side, so you're not completely filling up the carrier, if you know what I mean, with modulation. Now, when it comes to the EchoLink being fed back to you, I think you said it didn't sound correct. I'm sure there's other people on this frequency right now that have got a little more experience on EchoLink. Let's see if they can join us and give us a couple of comforting words as to what Steve should do next. Anyone else with EchoLink experience, please come back, give us your call letters and name, K2LIW in the DECnet. Looks like it's just you and me, Steve. Looks like no one else is volunteering EchoLink. So I think you're saying you had the EchoLink site you went to record and play back to you, and you were unhappy about the signal-to-noise ratio. I wonder, was it this repeater or some other repeater you were going through? But because every environment, particularly an environment like New York City, where you've got all kinds of metal in the building, the wiring, the pipes, the girders that hold the building together, whatever, that RF signal, in order to get to your handy-talkie, is being sifted through all kinds of jazz. Even though the signal at the repeater site is purely vertical, by the time it gets to you, there are hot spots and cold spots in the room, and you take, for instance, my particular situation out here in Huntington. I use my handy-talkie in the morning to listen to what's going on 146.85. That purely horizontal signal, when it gets to my bathroom, is purely vertical signal, when it gets to my bathroom, is horizontal. I lay my handy-talkie horizontal on a wooden shelf, on a fiberboard shelf, and that gives me the strongest signal. If I put my handy-talkie vertical, the signal almost fades out. And so that's the way Mother Nature behaves with multipath. So by a number of experiments, by some means, somebody feeding back the signal to you from the repeater, so you know how the repeater is hearing you when you transmit, and you move the handy-talkie around the room, you will find better spots even before you put up a better antenna.
Those are some of my suggestions, Steve, that I think will help. KC2QFJ, KQRIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Hi, very good, Dick. A little more information for you. The test setup that I was doing was for an EchoLink, what they call a sysop mode, where I was using my HD to transmit to another antenna right there in my, another radio right there in my QTH. That radio was hooked up then to the internet. So what I had was the HD with the rubber ducky antenna operating on 70 centimeter 445 simplex, but that was only just going out to the base, and I was doing this at my house in Rhode Island, so it wasn't in Manhattan. And by the way, I'm in New Rochelle, New York right now. So I was doing a test setup there in the house, so I was only a few feet away from my receiving antenna. And I felt exactly what your comment was, is that my audio was a little low, but on the menus here in the HD, I don't find anything that was like my game. So it sounds like maybe I just have to speak a little louder. But you generally listen on the input, I believe, and so I'm sounding okay as far as signal to noise rate, ratio or deviation. I didn't see anything in the menu about mic gain. I feel like I would need more mic gain if I was on a bigger radio.
You're absolutely right. I'm listening to you on the input, and on the input and on the output, you sound the same. Tiny bit of hiss because you're not dead full quieting on my input out here in Huntington, and you're not dead full quieting in this repeater. You're 95% audio and 5% hiss, if you know what I mean. But in both cases, the audio is a little bit low. It could be at least twice as loud. When you spoke closer to the mic and a little bit louder, it sounded better. So with that particular handy talkie, you might want to eat the mic, if you know what I mean, until you find the menu that gives you greater mic gain, greater deviation gain. It's got a couple of different names. Mic gain is the gain you've got in front of the audio limiter circuit. Deviation gain is what happens afterwards. And even if there isn't a menu for it, there probably is an internal potentiometer that can be adjusted. The next time you go to a LIMARC meeting of some kind, particularly a flea market, usually Andy, WA2CDL, sets up a tune-up clinic. He's got a service monitor, IFR or other brand name, by which he can measure your exact deviation, and he's quite familiar with 95% of the brand names, so if you want to, he could make the change to give you the right amount of audio. So that will help. And I guess each of the people who set up for EchoLink, it requires a number of experiments to get it just right, so you're not over-modulating, under-modulating, and getting a good enough signal-to-noise ratio to a particular repeater, if that's the method by which you intend to use EchoLink. Good luck with that project, Steve. And please come back in future weeks as you learn more about what you've got to do to make it sound more high fidelity. Let us know what you've discovered, because I think other people would like to hear what you did to make it better. KC2QFJ for any other comments. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. Thanks for that. You confirmed that, yes, I'm looking for more mic gain, or maybe I just need to be a little more aggressive on the microphone. But I think I'm pretty close. I'm on the other side of the room. And actually, that wasn't my primary question. My primary question was about the antenna, the dual bander. As I said, I thought it was a vertical dipole when I bought it. It's in a fiberglass radome. But actually, it's the literature describes itself as a two-element 5/8 wave for the 2 meter, and then a four-element 5/8 wave for 70 centimeters. And I was just wondering, I guess it's a collinear. And what's the comment about that?
At 8 o'clock, this is the W2VL repeater.
Okay, I'm a strong advocate of 5/8 wave antennas, and some manufacturers will call it a two-element collinear. It really is one radiating element, but as the radiating element goes from the minimum, which is usually around a quarter wavelength long, quarter wave ground plane wavelength, which requires a substantial ground plane. If it's a mag mount and it goes on the metal roof of the car, it'll work very well. If you connect it to a small radiator in the house, that may not be enough of a ground plane for it. But as the antenna goes to half wave and beyond, 5/8 wave is a skosh longer than half wave, all of a sudden you're feeding one end of the dipole, not the center, and it becomes a much higher impedance and much easier to feed once you got the right kind of impedance matching.